moving on in the Mishpatim, in these the civil or rational laws in the Torah. It's Parshas Mishpatim. The whole Parsha we're dealing with right now is called Mishpatim, which deals with really dozens and dozens of civil laws, laws between man and his fellow human being, laws that we put in the realm of being rational or being more legal rather than religious laws. So we're going to talk about a few interesting laws today. The first one I'd like to discuss is quoted in the beginning of the Parsha. Last week we discussed the laws of the Hebrew slave. So it's another law relevant to a slave. It's actually relevant to a Canaanite slave, which is the other type of slave we didn't discuss last week. And it says, Chiyake ish is abdo. If somebody was to strike his slave, osamaso, or his maidservant, but shave it with a staff, and the slave or maidservant dies from the blow, nakom yinakem, you shall surely avenge his death, meaning the person is liable to capital punishment. But this is where it gets interesting. But if the slave lives for a full 24 hours after the strike or the beating, then the owner is not liable to capital punishment. That's what the Torah says.
It's not liable.
It's not liable. So
they're
there's
not liable for battery. That sounds like they're not human. Punishment. Oh, he's not liable for capital punishment.
Capital punishment. So it's a very interesting distinction it makes, because if someone's to murder, let's say, a non-slave, another human being, so then whether the person dies within 24 hours or within 5 months, as long as the death is attributed to that strike, then you're liable to capital punishment. A person doesn't have to die within 24 hours to make the murderer liable. However, when it comes to the Canaanite slave, there's a special leniency of 24 hours. If the slave lives for 24 hours, then the one who beat the slave is no longer liable to capital punishment. So it's an interesting thing. We have to understand why that is. And I do want to point out that there are many times where you'll find different Torah laws or Torah values seem to conflict with our modern-day American sensitivities. And we just have to know that we have to take Torah for what it says. We can't ever water down what the Torah says. We have to look at the law that God gave us and say, this has to fit into what makes sense to us. If it doesn't, it's still God's law. This is the truth. This is called justice. This is the ultimate justice, the absolute justice from God. So even if our modern sensitivities have trouble understanding some of these laws, as Jews, we should believe that this is still ultimate justice from God. This is divine law, and we do our best to understand it. But it's still the divine law, whether or not we like it or not. So we do have this special leniency when it comes to killing a slave, that if the slave survives 24 hours and then dies, the one who beat the slave is exempt from capital punishment. So there's a few caveats about this law, conditions. Number one, this leniency only applies to the master himself. If someone else goes and beats a slave, then they're liable even if the slave dies later on. That's for sure. That's like any other murder. It's different here when the master beats the slave. That's one point. A second point, yes?
Does that include the master's agent beating the slave?
I assume so. I'm not sure, but I would assume so. But it's being done on behalf of the master, and we'll talk about why in a second. A second point, which is made by many commentaries, is that the word used here is he was hit with a staff. It doesn't say a sword or a knife or a club. It says the word a staff. And we'll talk about in a minute that the point is that was a usual tool used to discipline in those days, a staff. To take a sword and, God forbid, stab a slave is certainly like any other murder. There's no leniencies with that. That's a full-fledged murder. Take a knife, take any other type of weapon, beat the slave with it. And that's for sure like any other murder. Here it's unique because they're using a staff. And number three, the Or HaChaim, another commentator, points out that this leniency of 24 hours only applies if the master wasn't intentionally trying to hurt or murder the slave. He was rather just trying to discipline the slave. That's the third point made. So the gist we get of all these laws is that it's done in the course of discipline. In our minds, disciplining a human being in that way doesn't seem to fit. Our modern day sensitivities would say, well, you should never use corporal punishment to discipline anybody. Even nowadays with children, they talk about it's not wise to beat a child, to hit a child, to spank a child. That's a big discussion in parenting nowadays, too. But this whole concept of physical discipline is something which is very unfamiliar to us. Yeah?
Now, is the Hebrew word for staff the same as a walking stick?
The walking stick, I think, is usually called a makel. It's called a shevet. A shevet, like, what I'm trying to think of here. It says, Shiftecham, in the famous psalm, Shiftecham, which is the Mizmor of David, the psalm of David, Shiftecham, Mishantecha, your staff and your rod and your staff, they support me, they comfort me. So the same word there, Shevet. So that's the idea of a staff. So I guess the idea of the staff, it was, I guess you picture like a kid 100 years ago in a school, being those rulers lapping on his hand. There was some tool that was used to discipline slaves. And that was the common way to discipline a slave, through this type of staff. So if he was using any other type of weapon to discipline a slave, then that's 100% a murder. There's no leniencies with that. So in this situation, in the course of disciplining the slave, if he gets a little bit out of hand, and he hits the slave so harshly, that the slave dies in 24 hours, he's liable to capital punishment. And that's where this would apply. But if it takes more than 24 hours, so then the Luis is what I was giving, is that one is allowed to discipline a slave. There's verses quoted from Proverbs, I think it's from, it says that a slave will not be disciplined just through words. Sometimes he may require a little bit of a stronger discipline, is what the rabbis are telling us. And therefore, there is a license for a master to, within reason, discipline a slave. However, when he gets out of control to the point where the slave dies within 24 hours, it shows that the master was way out of hand. He was way too harsh. So then he's liable to capital punishment. He's a murderer at that point. So that's the law we have before us. So it's interesting to understand this law a little bit. What's the lesson the Torah is teaching us through this law? And there's a few lessons that are quoted. Number one, the disciplining and cruelty are two separate methods, two separate pathways. There's an idea of discipline, and again, in modern days, we might look at discipline differently as well. I mean, like again, even for children, they suggest not spanking these days. I mean, but modern-day wisdom have changed in terms of what discipline is, how discipline should work. And even modern-day rabbis, many of them say that the world has changed, children have changed, people have changed, and physical discipline may not be correct. There's a very fascinating article written by, there is a Hasidic Rebbe, the Piazetzner Rebbe, an amazing person. He was killed in the Holocaust. He lived in, I think it was the Warsaw Ghetto, it was one of the ghettos. He was killed during the Holocaust. And what he did, he wrote some book before the war. He also wrote a book during the war within the ghetto, and he buried all of his writings. He was taken off, he was killed, but some of the students were aware of where his writings were buried. And then after the war, they went back to Poland, and they dug up his writings. They published them in a book. It's called Esh Kodesh, the Holy Fire. And you read his writings, I mean, they're so powerful, because you know where he is at the time. He's sitting there in the ghetto. He lost his wife, he lost his kids, he lost everything. And he's still writing his Divrei Torah throughout. So he's a very powerful person, an amazing person. But before the war, he wrote a work called Chumas HaTalmidim, The Obligation of the Student. And the introduction to that he wrote was called, he wrote a message to the parents, I forgot what he called it, but in the beginning of that book, which discusses students' obligations, he writes a letter to parents. And one idea discusses is the way that children's attitudes have changed. And he was writing probably in the early 1900s when he wrote this book. But nowadays, even more so, it used to be that he says the children didn't mature, they didn't think they matured so fast. I mean, children nowadays think already age 12, 13, they're ready to take on the world. They think they know what they're doing. And then if a parent tries to discipline a child, so they're going to fight back. You know, and the parent tries to spank a child or hit a child, God forbid, the child will fight back. And the children aren't going to take that type of discipline. Because children nowadays, they feel more mature. So they have to understand more. They need explanations. They need a more gentle type of discipline. You go back a few hundred years ago, he claims that children in those days were much more taken to just be obedient. They didn't feel that they knew everything at age 12. They understood that we're young, our parents are wiser, our sages are wiser than us, and therefore we need things to be explained to us, we need to understand more. And if the parents said, do X, they would say, okay, we'll do it. And if the child didn't do it and they got a little bit of a spanking or something, then they would immediately... And it was okay back then because the children's attitudes were different, he says. Because nowadays, our children, since they think they know everything at a young age, so then physical discipline certainly isn't going to accomplish anything. Because they'll say, they'll just hit back the parent, they'll just run away. They're not obedient, they're not disciplined in the same way. But if you take them, you explain to them in a softer method, in a more intellectual method, with more of a care and emotion, nowadays is the best way to go. But he explains that the attitudes of children, for whatever reasons, have changed over the centuries. So that's just an interesting letter if you ever get a chance. It is published now in English too, I believe, that book, Chumas HaTalmidim, the duties of a student. But as an aside, but this idea of physical discipline, may have even been more effective in previous generations when the attitudes of the world were different. Now people are much, what's called, you know, after, you know, say the past few hundred years, or people are much more educated, enlightened, children seem to know a lot more at younger ages, at least they claim to know a lot more at younger ages, the schooling is better, the education is better, so then the whole pathway towards discipline is a different pathway. But that's as an aside. But the, so the many commentators explain, so what's the meaning of this law? That the master who beats a slave and the slave dies in 24 hours is liable to capital punishment. So some commentaries explain that, like I said before, there's a big difference between discipline and cruelty. Discipline means I have a goal. I want you to do X, Y, and Z. That'll be better for all of us if you do such a thing. Because I'm not doing it out of a sense of cruelty, but out of a sense of to be effective. I want to accomplish, I want to succeed. So then, you know, so a light discipline to a slave is something which the Torah sanctions. But if the master gets out of hand, the way he does becomes ruthless and cruel to the point where the slave is beaten nearly to death. So at that point we say that this is totally inappropriate, you're off course, that's not discipline anymore, it's cruelty. And if that slave dies within 24 hours, the master is liable to execution. That's one way explained in the commentaries. And it's that the commentary of the Ibn Ezra, he adds on an additional point, which is beyond the cruelty which is involved in beating the slave, but if a slave is beaten so terribly that he'll die in 24 hours, that means the master sees that in front of him. The master is beating a slave to the point where the slave is near death. So he should see in front of him the severe situation and stop. But why does he continue going? Why doesn't the master have a little mercy on this slave? He sees that he's in so much pain. So, you know, a little hit on the wrist with a ruler like they were doing in school, okay, so that's discipline. But if you're beating the slave to the point where he's in so much pain and he's so injured, and you don't stop, so that's an extra measure of being ruthless or cruel, which the Torah says is totally out of line and is liable to execution if the slave dies. The Abarbanel adds an additional point. He says that a master who's so cruel, we're concerned with what he'll do in the future. If a person can be so cruel to beat a slave in front of him to death, then this person, we're scared for what he'll do next week, in a month from now. What's he going to do with the society? He's such a cruel and ruthless person. So that's why he's liable to death. So, but also, all the three of these approaches are talking about how the person is just so harsh. It's such an insensitive, cruel, ruthless person that we can't have this person around anymore. Whether it be because he's not disciplining, he's actually trying to hurt another human being. Whether it be because he sees the slave in pain in front of him and doesn't stop. Whether because we're scared what's going to happen in the future. But all three of these reasons are showing this person is just so cruel and ruthless that that's why it's such a severe punishment, severe crime. There's another interesting angle to this, which is from the Sefer HaChinuch. The Sefer HaChinuch, again, it's one of these books that we're commonly quoting, explains different mitzvahs and laws. This is a very interesting point. He says that, why would a master beat a slave so severely? So probably the master lost control. He's so angry that the slave is not doing what he wants. He lost control of himself and keeps on hitting the slave. So Sefer HaChinuch points out that the Torah wishes to uproot this type of behavior. You know, the anger, losing control of our tempers is something which becomes, you know, it really takes over a person. I mean, everybody gets angry at some point in life, and we know a lot of times we lose control when we're angry. We do things we regret after the fact. We do things that might be foolish or even laughable. But people point out, if someone were to video us when we're angry, and we looked at the video afterwards, we laugh at ourselves. We look so silly sometimes. Because we realize that anger, we lose control when we're angry. We're just totally out of our hands. That's how terrible this midah is. This trait of having a terrible temper, losing control, is a terrible thing. And people do things that they regret, that are awful, that are just totally, you know, illogical when they're angry. So, the Sefer HaChinuch points out, a master beating a slave in such a cruel manner, odds are this master has lost his temper. He's lost control. He doesn't want to kill his slave. He doesn't want to do such a thing. You know, obviously the assumption is the rule, but the assumption would be that the master just lost control and he just keeps on beating the slave out of his temper, out of his loss of his own personal self-control. So the Torah wants to say that midah is such a terrible midah. This character trait is so despicable that somebody loses control at this point that they can beat and kill another human being. That's an awful thing and deserves execution. That's the Torah's thing. And it trains everybody around to understand how terrible this type of behavior is. Losing control, having an anger which is uncontrollable, such a terrible position to be in, that we all have to work on our midos. And for somebody who has an anger problem, it's a very difficult thing to overcome. A lot of people do have issues with anger. It's a very difficult trait to keep in control. It's a very difficult thing. I think I mentioned before, there was a famous story, I think it was from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, founder of the Musar movement. I think it was him. He would have a special anger hat. He'd leave it in his closet. And he would say, well, I feel angry. I'm not allowed to get angry since I'm wearing that hat. So he'd have to go to the closet and get the hat on. By the time he got to the closet, usually by then, like, the anger died down a little bit, you know?
I like that.
So it's, yeah, so I'm allowed to get angry, but I have to put my hat on to get angry.
I like that.
Yeah, it's a great idea. Because usually if we give ourselves 2 minutes, we would lose control. We would collect ourselves, be able to reverse the situation logically, rationally. But we just blow up, so then that's when things go out of hand. Yeah.
When you put on the hat, everybody knows to get the hat.
Yeah. That's so true, too. So they wouldn't have to be the subject to anger, you know, it helps also. Yes, that was I think it was Rabbi Sosomander. I think that was his way to deal with anger. It's a great practical advice, because usually, really, give it 1 minute, and you won't get angry. At least you won't lose control. You'll be within control. But if you just blow up in a situation, that's when we lose control totally. There's a cute idea. It's related, not exactly related, but tangentially related to what we're discussing, to anger. It's an idea quoted from the great Stipler Gaon, Rabbi Yisrael Yaakov Kanievsky. He was one of the great sages in Israel, in the early 1900s, mid-1900s. His son, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, right now is one of the greatest sages in the world at this point. That's his son, lives in Bnei Brak. So he's referred to as the Stipler Gaon. So he has a piece about the plague of frogs.
Plague of frogs?
Frogs, yeah. Plague of frogs. And it's a very interesting description you find in the Midrash. Because the Midrash tells us how the plague of frogs work. And it's based on quotes from the Torah itself. The Midrash tells us that what happened was there was one frog that jumped out of the Nile. Many of you may have heard this before. One frog jumped out of the Nile. Jumped out of the Nile. So they said, oh, a frog. Oh, well, Moses said frogs are coming. We better kill this frog. So they took their clubs. They beat the frog. The frog was divided into two. Every time they hit the frog, it started dividing and dividing and dividing. Eventually, the whole land was filled with frogs. So it wasn't that just millions of frogs jumped out of the Nile. It was one frog that every time it got hit, divided into two frogs. That's how the rabbis described the plague of frogs. So the Stipler Gaon, he asked the question. He says, oh, wait a minute, why didn't the Egyptians catch on? if you keep hitting the frog, it makes more frogs, so just stop hitting the frog.
Right.
There'll only be a couple frogs around. What's the big deal?
Didn't the Jews want the frogs? Didn't God want the frogs?
But the Jews weren't beating the frogs, the Egyptians were beating the frogs.
Oh.
So why did these Egyptians catch on? Why would it be that they keep hitting these frogs? So he says that it was out of anger. He says that just like when it comes to anger, in this situation, saying because the Egyptians were angry, so you lose control. You're not logical. You're not rational. You're angry. So you just keep getting these out of here. These things. This stupid Moses. What's he doing to us? You keep hitting all the frogs, and suddenly there's a million frogs jumping around. People who are angry don't think rationally all the time. So you're doing it out of anger. So then you keep on doing things which are foolish and illogical. That's what keeps on happening. But he says that it really applies on a very practical level to us. Because many times, like we were saying before, you know, if we're angry and we just took a break, chilled out, then nothing bad would come out of it. Everyone would calm down, we would talk, and everything would be okay. But because we're not thinking rationally, we escalate the situation. We yell back, they yell back, we yell back, and they yell back, and then we say something more nasty, and then suddenly everything escalates. So it's like that one frog that turns into a million frogs. That's how anger works. You know, we could be that we do something I'm upset about, and I'm quiet, just ignore it and move on. And eventually, things fall back into place, and our relationship, you know, restarts. But if I start screaming at you, you get mad at me, you scream back. You know, the situation will escalate to the point where it can break relationships. It can cause major, major problems. So that's the analogy given from these frogs. So that's the idea. So anger is something which, so you look at this master beating his slave. So it's what he's doing is not the desired result. It's irrational. He doesn't want to kill his slave. That's not what he wants. But because he's doing it out of a sense of anger, people lose control. Just we keep beating the frogs and it escalates. Just like when we yell at somebody and we say things that are nasty to somebody else, the situation escalates. So too, this person, he allowed the situation to escalate to the point where he murdered somebody. And that's how terrible that trait of anger could be. So that's the idea of this law of beating the slave.
depends on Hashem getting angry with Jewish people.
So that's a good question, which really takes another discussion. Usually when you find any of these traits described in the Torah about Hashem, so Hashem doesn't have emotions. Hashem doesn't have, he doesn't lose control of the temper. What it means is that Hashem displays anger towards us so we can learn the lesson. And Hashem displaying anger means that we've done something wrong. So we have to see God's anger so we learn our lesson. It's not that Hashem has lost control. Hashem doesn't have emotions. Hashem is one.
Parsha, last week's parsha, the spies, was very severe with Hashem's anger against the Jewish people.
Right. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get too off topic on that, but just anytime an emotion is described with Hashem, it's a display. Let me give you an example. A great teacher. So you have a third grade teacher, right? So the kids do something which is really bad. So a teacher who feels a personal frustration with the class may lose control and scream at the kids and whatever he may do. And that's not an effective way of disciplining the kids necessarily. That's just he's lost control. A really good, effective teacher says, well, I'm not personally angry with the kids. They're kids. I have to teach them. But they have to see that it was very wrong. So I have to display to them a sense of anger. Not that I lost control. I have to display anger to them so they realize what we did was such a terrible thing. So you have to look at Hashem in the same way. Hashem doesn't have emotions. There's no...
Well, wait a minute. I mean to contradict you, but if you look at the parsha and what it says, it's very explicit with Hashem being angry with the Jewish people until their carcasses shall drop in the desert and they shall know my anger. I'm not quoting exactly, but it's something similar to that.
You're right. The description is a description of anger. I'm just saying.
It says, Hashem, I am angry with these people, and they're going to die because of this.
Hashem has a structure to the order of things. So it's not this master beating the slave is like an uncontrollable out of body experience.
I came in a little bit late. I'm not sure of the overall discussion. What is the topic of the overall discussion? How anger is wrong?
No.
Well, there's a law about the slave. We're actually moving to the next law.
Controlled anger, where you're not. It's
right.
Not. Go ahead.
Well, I think that the discussion of Hashem's emotions is itself a long discussion. I mean,
we're supposed to imitate Hashem, correct?
Right.
So we'll
talk about it
another time.
Yeah.
Inconvenient truth.
It's not a bad question. It's just off topic for today. I don't want to get into it. Hashem's emotions are very different than what we're going to get to today.
So then
the next law I want to discuss for today from Mishpatim is the Torah discusses when a person injures another human being, what the law would be. And this is just, many may be familiar with the rule in the situation, but it's just important to understand what's the Torah's truth. If somebody was to beat another human being, hurt another human being, injure another human being, so what is the ruling in a Jewish court? So the Torah tells us that there's five different payments which are required when a Jew hurts another human being. What are those five payments? So one is called nezek. And nezek means that, we mentioned last week, every person does have value in the slave market. In their days, there's a slave market, there's a value in the slave market. So a human being does have a monetary worth. So let's say right now, when I'm a healthy human being, maybe I'm worth $20,000 in the slave market. But now that somebody came and broke my wrist, so I wouldn't go for the same price right now. That would lower my value. So the first payment is called nezek, which is you're paying the difference in the objective value of the person that you injured. That's number one. The second payment, called sheves, and sheves means you pay for his loss of time at work. So a person has to take off a week of work because they were injured, so the person who, the injurer, has to pay that person's lost time at work.
What's that word again, please?
Sheves.
Sheves.
Sheves. Like Shabbos, like is resting. So sheves, I mean, his time off work, his resting time from work has to be paid for. There's a third payment called ripui, which is pay the medical bills. So he has to go to the doctor, and it costs him $1,000 in medical bills. So then the perpetrator has to pay for the medical bills. Tsar is the fourth payment. Pay for the person's pain. It was an interesting type of payment. So let's say that the person burned me. It was very painful. So he covered my loss of value in the slave market. He covered my loss of time at work. And he covered the medical bills. But I need some form of payment to at least compensate for my pain that I went through. So there's a payment called sar. It's for pain.
That also includes mental suffering.
I don't think that's included in sar.
In English, people say pain and suffering.
Right. Yeah. I don't think we pay for mental suffering.
Okay.
The fifth payment is a type of mental suffering. Not the same you'll talk about in, let's say, the American court system. But the fifth payment is called boshas. You pay for the person's embarrassment. Mm-hmm. Let's say it happened in public, and I was humiliated. Whatever happened, you know, it was in public, and this guy came over and he decked me in the face. People were watching. Whatever the case may be. So there was an embarrassment involved there. The person's pay for my shame. And there's a way the court evaluates and assesses how much it's worth. I mean, it's very hard to assess how much is your embarrassment worth. But the court has a system how they assess how much the embarrassment's worth. Those are the five payments. So the justice which is brought when another human being hurts another human being and injures somebody else are through these five payments. This covers really all aspects of the injury. That's the idea of those five payments. There's 2 points I'd like to make about these five payments. Just side points, but interesting points. The Torah talks about paying for medical bills, and the wording used says "rapo yirapei," shall surely heal him. So there's two very interesting points made about these words "rapo yirapei," shall surely heal them. Number one is the Gemara tells us that from this verse we see that there is permission that one can go to a doctor, which sounds strange, but if you think about it, we believe God's in control of the world. God heals. God gives life. God takes life. So maybe going to a doctor is considered a lack of trust in God. Why am I going to a human being to help me? I should stop it. God will help me.
Some religion believes
that. Some religions do that, yeah. Yeah. I think Christian scientists, I think, that they won't go to doctors. I remember there was a case a few years ago. There was a kid, I think, who had cancer, and the state... The state, I think it was like a Minnesota story a few years ago. I think it was Minnesota, somewhere in the Midwest. There was a kid, I think, who had cancer. His family was of one of these faiths, doesn't use doctors. And I think that the state was mandating that the parents take him to a doctor. And they had to flee. They fled the state because of this, because they didn't want to go to the doctor. So there are religions that actually believe this. The Torah tells us, no, Rapo Yirapei, that you shall go see the doctor. So Gemara points out from here, we see that God tells us that the way we should take care of ourselves if we're sick is to go see a doctor. And of course, we have to believe that the ultimate healing comes through God, but we can't rely upon miracles. We have to go through normal human means. And even so, if God deems that we should be healed, we're healed. If God deems we shouldn't be healed, God forbid, that we won't be healed. But we can't just sit back and say, well, God just healed me. We have to go through normal human measures to become healthy. That's one interesting point here.
They pulled, a while ago, they asked surgeons across the country, do they believe that their ability to heal was their own skills or it came from God, and over 65% said it came from God.
Wow.
And they didn't have, over 65% said they were not that skilled, and that the miracles that came or the healing that came through their hands was God.
Wow.
Right. Yeah. No, they both
said. It didn't say that.
Third, yeah.
But if you were thinking.
65 is pretty good, yeah.
One out of three.
We have to deal with who the population is. These are not all Jews. These aren't the population of surgeons throughout the country or everybody else but Jews.
Right.
Jews are now going into business anyway. So you have to realize who this population is.
I think it's a good screening question if you ever have to get a surgery.
I just thought I'd toss that out.
I asked a doctor, a physician one time recently, do you believe in God? And he told me no.
Okay, well then he's in the 35%. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's interesting stat.
It's really a true story.
Yeah.
Because we were talking to him about homeopathy, which is, you know, not in the mainstream of medical thinking. And he said to me, there's three things I don't believe in. I don't believe in witchcraft, homeopathy, and God.
Oh, wow.
That's what he told me.
Wow, another doctor.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Right. No, but it's
Sure,
it's interesting stat. There's another point here, interesting point in these words. So the words used are rapo yirapei. Now in Hebrew we know that you have a pe and a fe. Fe has the softer F sound and the pe has that harder P sound. It has the dot in the middle. So there's a commentary, Rabbeinu Bechaya, one of the classic commentaries. He points out that any time in the Torah a human being is doing the healing, the letter uses the pei, rapo yirapei, the human being shall heal. Go to the doctor, rapo yirapei. In a case where we find God doing the healing, it's a softer sound, it's the fei. Like when we say in the Shemona Esrei, refa'inu, refa'u shleima, refa'inu Hashem v'nei rafei, you should heal us God and we'll be healed. The softer sound, the fei. So he points out a fascinating idea. Why do you have that distinction in the words? He says that when a human being heals you, there's a lot of side effects. It's very invasive. It's very uncomfortable. It's the harder sound. It's the harsher pace sound. He's really, they're digging in on you. When the healing comes straight from God, so God does it from the inside. It's not invasive. It's not uncomfortable. That's the idea of so God heals. It's refa'inu. It's much softer, pleasant, gentle healing. We have to go to see a doctor. Even the doctor heals with God's power, but the doctor, this human being, has to do it in a much more invasive, uncomfortable way. So it's rapo, the harder pace sound. So I thought that was a fascinating point.
What do those two words mean, by the way? Rapo, yirapei.
Rapo, yirapei. He shall heal him.
What does that mean?
It's a refuah. It's the same. It's the same.
Yeah, but it's twice. He shall heal.
The double. Let me find double language in the Torah. So if you look at the official Archscroll translation of it, they always say, he shall surely heal him, would be the Archscroll translation. Okay. But the Gemara, whenever there's a double wording, always tells you there's a lesson to learn from a double wording.
In ancient times, were there schools or something to teach people how to be a physician?
I believe so. I mean, I don't know
how. Is it commonly written?
You follow the doc. It was an apprentice.
Oh, I see. It was an apprenticeship situation.
Interesting. I mean, the Talmud discusses doctors all the time. There are a few of the great authors of Talmud were doctors.
Maimonides
is later on. He was a very famous doctor. But even earlier, Shmuel, one of the big names in the Talmud, was a doctor. He was a doctor. So you find him, healing others within the Talmud. But not as a miracle worker, but as a doctor. He was a trained doctor. So. I believe it goes back to the time of the Greeks, ancient Greeks, medicine.
Who was the first doctor? Was it Hippocratic Oath or something?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I think it's really started. The science of medicine, I think, began around the ancient Greeks.
In the Jewish community, the practice of medicine occurred during the Greek times when the Greeks.
Yeah, but I think in the broader community, I think really ancient Greeks began modern day medical research.
Where the Jews.
Right. Okay. Well, Jews were very, very heavily influenced by the Greeks also at that point. Yeah. The Greeks.
That's the oral tradition.
Oral
tradition has a lot of.
No, not Samuel the prophet, but Shmuel, the one in the Gemara, a different Samuel.
Oh, a different one.
Not the prophet, a different one.
I think there was another tradition of like folk medicine or folk healing, with even before formal medicine or.
Yeah, there's
somebody in the tribe or in the group, and you take this herb or you take this thing and you crush it and you drink it. And
right.
I think that went on for.
I think it's the modern day type of medical research that we have, I think, began more in the Greek, Greek period.
Right.
So that's another interesting point about rapo yirapei. The rafua versus with a pei, rapo, the harsher pei. And one other interesting point, which we find, is the famous verse here, eye for an eye, which is quoted all the time, often. I guess in the wrong context, but you have here the verse, the same parsha we're looking at has a verse, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a hand for a hand, a foot for a foot, a burn for a burn, a wound for a wound, a bruise for a bruise. That's the verse. So if you took the Torah literally here, you'd say, okay, I knocked out your eye, you knocked out my eye. And that's the literal translation of the words. The Talmud tells us that's not what it means. The Talmud tells us it means that you pay monetary reparations. You have to pay the value of the eye. Which says one of the payments you pay for what was lost. So the question, it begs the question, well, if you read the verse literally, eye for an eye, we should take it literally. I'll knock out your eye. Then the Talmud comes and says, no, that doesn't really mean that. You have to take it as more of a, let's say, an analogy, more of a metaphor, and it really means you pay the value of the eye.
What's the rationale? The Talmud.
I want to address that right now. And just as an aside, so we believe that the oral tradition of the Talmud came hand in hand with the Torah, and this was God's intent of the words "eye for an eye." But then, why would God write it in this way, which is not clear? That's the question. So it is discussed in the Talmud, but the one who explains it very clearly here, the commentary on the Torah, the Sephorno. The Sephorno says that why does the Torah write it literally, an eye for an eye? So he says, In terms of absolute justice, this would be the proper punishment. Mita kaneged mita, you know, measure for measure. Justice means you lose your eye, but because of me, I lose my eye as well. That's the absolute just thing to do. Yeah. But the Talmud tells us there should be a monetary payment. Why? Because he says, it's because who are we to judge? Let's say, for instance, you know, maybe my eye, may I have better eyesight than you? Maybe my eye will cause more of a problem. If you remove my eye, God forbid, maybe it'll cause more of a problem. They all get infected. I mean, we have no way as humans to know that this is an exact measure for measure type punishment. So because of that, we can't actually fulfill this ideal of an eye for an eye. So the Torah tells you, you know, justice would mean eye for an eye exactly. The oral tradition tells us, but that's not practical because we're not a guy that we don't know. Is my eye the same as your eye? Do I see as well as you? Does my eye, maybe my eye will have other side effects your eye doesn't have if it gets removed? So because of that, we can't actually execute this punishment, and instead we pay monetary reparations. So that's the idea here in specific. But in general, we have to view that if the Torah says something literally, and the Talmud says it means something else, there's a message in both. The Torah is saying, in an ideal world, from God's angle, God who can see the future, and God who can understand my eye versus your eye, so the ideal approach would be an eye for an eye. That's the ideal. Yeah.
And suppose you have one eye, and you did that, and you have to lose your other eye, then you can even blind.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's another good point. Right, yeah. Because he can at least still see, you know, I'm blind.
Yeah, he can
right.
See
yeah.
That I'm blind completely.
Right.
Right.
That's not equal. Right, it's not equal. No. So we understand the world of justice, there should be an equal punishment, but as human beings, we can't practically execute that type of punishment, therefore we can't do it. That's the that's the idea of the eye for an eye.
I think the Talmud does discuss the other proposition.
It does discuss it, but that's not the conclusion.
But it does mean...
That's not the conclusion of the Talmud.
No, that's not conclusion.
The conclusion of the Talmud is monetary payment.
But there is a debate about whether it does mean that.
Right.
Rabbi, thank you.
Right. Have a good day.
Yeah, thanks.
Have a good day.
One more minute here. There's actually more I wanted to get to today we didn't get to. Wow. But let's go for one more minute. Let's look at something else. There's another famous concept here, which is... Actually, we'll hold off on that for next week. I'll discuss one other thing. I'll ask more particularly for next week. There's an interesting quote. Now they're just discussing, you know, damages, monetary damages, you know, people injuring others. So there's a quote in the Talmud. It says, "Mande boil mehadi chasida," somebody who wants to become a chassid, an extremely righteous person. So what should you do? It says you should focus your attention on nezikin, on damages. Be very careful about damaging others. And then it says, and some say you should focus your attention on brachos, making proper blessings. And some say you should focus your attention on pirkei avos. So three different opinions in the Talmud. How do you become a very righteous person? What's the idea to become a chassid? So the famous commentary of the Maharal explains how these three things work together. Some say focus on damages. Some say focus on brachos, on blessings. Some say focus on the words of pirkei avos. So how do those three things work together? So the Maharal is famous for categorizing that there are three different, it's called relationships, first you can have. A relationship between yourself and God, between yourself and other human beings, and between yourself and yourself, your own personal, how you relate to yourself. So he says that we have to perfect ourselves in all three areas. So to perfect our relationship between us and other human beings, so damages is what to focus on. If I'm sensitive towards you and towards your property, so it helps me to perfect in how I relate to you. So I respect you and I respect who you are and I respect what you have and the work you've done. That's one level of relationship. So when the Talmud says focus on damages, it's coming to perfect the relationship between a human being and a fellow human being.
Yeah.
When it says in the Talmud focus on blessings, on brachos, so that perfects the relationship between you and God. If you're constantly showing gratitude towards God, understanding that God is the one who provides your food, and God is the one who provides healing, God is the one who provides the weather, and God, when you're making all the proper blessings, so then that perfects the relationship between you and God. And then the third opinion in the Talmud that you should focus on the words of Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos teaches you how to relate to yourself. What are proper character traits? What are inappropriate character traits? What are good attitudes and perspectives? What are inappropriate attitudes and perspectives? That trains you how to relate to yourself. So the Talmud is giving you a full picture. How does one perfect all the relationships out there? So to focus on others, you're careful about damaging other people. To focus on God, you're careful with your brachos. To focus on your own personal attitudes, your personal character, you should focus on Pirkei Avos. That's the idea. So when we look at this whole discussion of damaging other people, hurting other people, damaging their property, there's a larger picture, which is sensitivity towards others, respecting others, understanding other people, what they have is theirs, and I have to be careful not to hurt them, I have to be careful of their emotions, be sensitive towards them. That's the bigger picture. And that can, one who's always has this in mind, can become a chassid, can become extremely righteous and pious in the world of relating to other people. And then we can focus on brachos and Pirkei Avos and perfect the other worlds as well. And I think we'll stop here.